Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland, and this is the Marketplace Money Podcast for the weekend of May 21st, 2010. Greece is dealing with a major economic crisis, but it's not all bad news, especially if you're looking to travel.
Icelandic volcanoes permitting. Going to Europe during this summer is anywhere between 20 to 25% cheaper than it was last year.
The dollar may get you to Europe on the cheap, but for a kid in the city, a buck a week? Come on!
In New York, I'd have to save for 5 weeks just to buy an ice cream cone and forget about movie or makeup.
A teen, a mom, and an allowance throwdown. But first, it took more than a month for the oil spewing from the bottom of the Gulf of Mexico to slosh its way toward land. But finally this week, it appeared, lapping at the shores of Louisiana's marshlands and confirming the worst fears of those who make their living in the Gulf's waters and along its shoreline. A very personal chaos is playing out in addition to the environmental wreckage in thousands of homes where incomes are threatened by the disaster. From WBHM in Birmingham, Alabama, Tanya Ott reports.
It's Friday morning, and Tracy Thrasher quietly scrambles to make the beds in a vacation home in Gulf Shores, Alabama. Tourists are in town for a music festival, and they need somewhere to stay.
I'm doing a rush job because they're already here and they're wanting to rent the house. So I have to run in and try to get it as clean as I can.
Tracy's just happy to have the work. She cleans vacation rental homes. But since the oil rig exploded last month, tourists have been canceling their vacations all the way through July. Tracy's worked just 2 days in the last 3 weeks. Her income has gone from $800 a week to just $100. Her husband, Kelly, is a building contractor who depends on vacation rentals for most of his business. He says their financial well is running dry.
Normally this time of year, I'm working 7 days a week around the clock. You know, just like today, I get a half a day. And it's just not happening. People ain't coming.
And they may not be for a while.
I and you both know right now there's no oil on these beaches. You know, but the people's not here. You know, how do you tell them that there's no oil on the beaches? You can't. I mean, they don't believe it.
The Thrashers can't believe their bad luck. In 2004, Hurricane Ivan's high winds and surf devastated this part of Alabama. Hurricane Katrina hit the following year, and before the region had time to recover, Tracy Thrasher says they were hit with a third stroke of bad luck, the mortgage crisis.
Most definitely stress. Stress all the way around.
Insurance companies delayed their payments to people whose homes were damaged in the hurricanes. That, along with the housing crash, meant Kelly couldn't find much work. The Thrashers burned through $12,000 in savings in just a few years. Tracy took a job cleaning rental homes this spring. Sometimes Kelly helps out.
Extra cash. We need more money. With the economy the way it is, nobody's doing any construction work, so we figured we'd start cleaning houses.
Kelly sold his two precious motorcycles. Tracy loved going to the movies. They don't anymore. They started renting videos, but the only place in town recently closed. The Thrashers have also sliced and diced the food budget.
Instead of going and spending $100 for the week, you go and spend $40 for the week. Sandwiches instead of steaks.
Emily, their fourth-grade daughter, is a voracious reader. She loves Japanese comic books called manga. She used to feed her addiction with frequent visits to Books a Million, but now she has to rely on the library.
It feels kind of sad, because there's like this one manga that I really want to have, but I can't have it. They don't have mangas in the library at school.
Oh, it's so hard. How do you explain to a 9-year-old, we need to cut back? You know, I'm sorry, allowance maybe next week.
Or maybe not, since there is nothing to fall back on. Kelly Thrasher has always been self-employed and never saved for retirement. Those are things for rich corporate-type people, he says. Applying to British Petroleum for reimbursement of lost income won't help much. BP wants 2 years' worth of tax returns. But Tracy's only been cleaning houses for a few months, and Kelly... well, he admits he does a lot of work for cash.
Well, I mean, I guess you pull the newspaper out and start looking for another job.
Kelly's already lined up a job 300 miles north in Birmingham. It's a quick one-time gig that pays a couple $1,000s. But subtract the gas and a motel for him and his crew, and Kelly says there will be little left over. This tragedy in the Gulf may prompt some families to change their financial lives. But for this family, and probably many others, that's just not possible. In Gulf Shores, Alabama, I'm Tanya Ott for Marketplace Money.
The Senate passed its version of the financial reform bill this week. Now they'll try to reconcile it with the House version. Both give more power to regulators and they establish a Consumer Financial Protection Agency. But will they be able to protect us from ourselves? There was a lot of talk over the last year and a half about how we'd be forced off our credit addiction because banks wouldn't be giving it out so freely. But have you checked the mailbox lately? Credit card solicitations are way up. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek-Smith has that story.
Americans and credit cards made beautiful music together. Credit card companies loved us for the overstretched, impulsive consumers that we were. And we loved how they gave and gave and gave.
You are so beautiful.
By 2008, Americans owed more than $900 billion on their credit cards. Then the economy collapsed and we couldn't pay our bills. Card companies lost $150 billion. They stopped writing. They stopped calling. Plastic was breaking up with us.
Tell me, how am I supposed to live without you?
We went from getting 8 billion card offers a year to just a billion. Andrew Davidson studies cards for Mintel Compromedia. He says card offers dried up for all but the credit superstars.
What we saw was the profile of the entire mailbox shifted to what the industry terms as prime or super prime customers, those with very good credit histories.
That's changing. Card companies like Chase and HSBC are jamming our mailboxes with offers, and people with simply good credit are getting wooed again, too. Solicitations are up more than 80% this year. Credit cards want us back.
I'm all out of love. What am I without you?
What changed? The economy's improving and defaults are down, but card companies also need us like never before. Credit card reform is expected to cost card companies more than $10 billion a year in lost interest and fees. And then there's us. We're just not that into credit anymore. David Robertson publishes the Nilson Report, an industry trade journal.
We have changed the way we look at credit, even those people who are creditworthy and employed and quite capable of paying their bills have stopped really making discretionary payments with a credit card.
Enter a new round of rewards and incentives to win us back. Ron Shevlin analyzes banking products for the Aite Group.
They're bolstering cash back, how much they will pay back on groceries or gas purchases, making it easier to redeem, doing merchant-funded reward programs.
Not so fast. This isn't the naive romance of a few years ago, and it's not unconditional love anymore. Bill Hardikoff is CEO of LowCards.com.
Issuers are relaxing a little bit more in the sense of they're soliciting more people, but I think they're being careful as to not taking on too much risk.
They're also charging higher interest rates and tacking on more fees. Oh, relationships. Why are they always so complicated? In Los Angeles, I'm Stacey Vanek-Smith for Marketplace Money.
And this is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Here's another complicated relationship, parents and kids, especially when it comes to figuring out all this money stuff. I mean, who wants to have that awkward conversation about how much allowance kids deserve? Well, Beth Koblenner wrote a book called Get a Financial Life, and she is the mother to three kids, so it's safe to say she's handled this question herself. We asked Beth and her oldest daughter, Becca, to give us a peek into the negotiations.
We recently started giving our kids $1 per year old per week. So my 11-year-old iTunes-loving son gets $11. My 6-year-old rams $6 a week into a charity box that he made in religious school. I think he's taking literally the expression, charity begins at home. And my eldest daughter, Becca, gets $14, which she takes issue with. Right, Becca?
Well, yeah, Mom, but that's because it started late last year. And up until then, you were giving us all just $1 a week. In New York, I'd have to save for 5 weeks just to buy an ice cream cone and forget about movie or makeup.
We already pay for most of your needs, lunches, basic clothes, and after-school activities. Allowance is supposed to cover treats like going out for ice cream or buying earrings or headbands or makeup at the mall. And it seems to me that $56 a month for a 14-year-old is enough to make money for extras like that.
Well, when you say it that way, it sounds like a lot, but on a week-to-week basis, $14 a week isn't that much in New York City. I mean, if I want to see a movie with my friends, that's already $12.50. And that means no popcorn, no pizza, and nothing else. And it gets awkward. I don't want to ask my friends for the money.
I know you wouldn't want to do that, but the reality is that since we started this new allowance situation, I often pay for the main event, like the movie. And because this is all new territory, going out by yourself without Dad or me, it's about your choices and your responsibility.
Well, what about chores? I'm happy to do chores to make more money.
Sorry, no deal. Chores are about being part of the family, not about hitting us up every time the dishwasher needs emptying. If we started to pay you for making your bed or, you know, clearing the table or making polite conversations at dinner, we'd be paying you to be part of the family. I think one thing we have to decide is what needs are. So, like last weekend when I gave you $60 for clothes when you went to the mall with friends, I mean, it's spring and you've definitely grown again and you do need clothes.
Yeah, I'm now officially 4 inches taller than my mom.
Well, it was an experiment to see how you make choices when shopping for clothes all by yourself. But you came back with makeup. And when I asked you for the $60 back, you said you thought I gave you the money to spend however you liked on yourself. And you didn't save the receipt from the makeup, so we couldn't return it.
Well, I got a little confused because you told me the money was to buy things, but you didn't really specify it was for things I needed. And I honestly didn't think to ask for the receipt because I haven't done it before.
You're right. I mean, I should have been clearer. So from now on, your allowance money is for wants, and for needs, like basic clothes that fit you, I'll give you a separate dollar amount to cover that, or we can just go shopping together.
I don't know. I mean, what you consider wants, I might consider needs. Like makeup. Makeup is definitely a need.
Well, would you prefer that Dad and I give you a bigger allowance? But listen, that would mean that every time you buy lunch or snacks or frozen yogurt or accessories or movies, even gifts for friends and activities, that would come from the allowance. And if you use that money up, you have to wait until next month. But if you have the money left over, then you could save it.
I'm not sure. I don't have to pay for that much as it is. And I think that if I got a bigger allowance, it might mean that I'm actually getting less money per month, since you'd expect me to pay for more than I do right now. But on the other hand, if I got a little more a month, I would definitely give some to charity.
You do realize you're on the radio right now. I mean, I do have lots of witnesses.
And so do I.
Did you just talk me into giving you a bigger allowance on national radio? All right, already. We'll work out the details when we get home.
Beth Koblenner and her oldest daughter, Rebecca, with The Allowance Diaries. Families in Greece are bearing the brunt of that country's troubles. Even teenagers are feeling the pain.
She comes home from time to time from school now and asks, why did we get into this crisis? Why are we being criticized?
The Greek Crisis Comes Home. That's later on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland, and it's time once again for your questions. And helping us out this week is Kathy Kristoff of CBS Money Watch. Welcome back.
Well, thanks so much. It's great to be here.
So, you know, today we're going to be taking some calls that all have to do with how families deal with money. And I know we've talked before a little bit about how, you know, you kind of grew up as a saver and you kind of knew what you were doing with your money. But but I think I remember that your sister didn't.
Right.
Right.
Right. Every family, you have all these different personalities. And some of that is a money personality. I see my children being very much the same.
Really? You
know? Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean,
one good with money, one not.
It's more that one is a spender and one is not. And one's much more likely to get a job than the other. You know, and we're hoping that will change, that they'll both get jobs. But yeah.
Where do you think that dynamic comes from?
I think that we are who we are at birth. And as parents, what we get to do is modify that behavior a little bit. I've always talked to my kids a lot about money. I've tried to do a lot of things to make them responsible.
And they definitely know they have to pay their taxes, right?
Oh, yeah.
Well, Janine is on the line from Louisville, Kentucky, and she's got a situation with her boyfriend and money and taxes. Hi, Janine.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
So what do you do there in beautiful Louisville, Kentucky? Are you a horse trainer? Do you get sick of being asked that?
No, I work in a restaurant.
Okay.
And I do have a family. Just work and family. That's about it for these years.
So let's talk a little bit about your question. And you wrote in about your boyfriend and his taxes. Tell us a little bit about, well, first of all, how long have you been together?
Almost 20 years we've been together, and he's never filed taxes.
Oh, boy.
What does he do?
He works in the construction industry.
So all of his income comes to him in cash, so there's no record of him earning it?
Yes, there are records. Yeah, the taxes were taken out. It wasn't as if he was a subcontractor. He just has never filed. There were probably some years when money was due back to him, but he wouldn't know because he never filed.
Kathy, is that surprising that he's never been caught?
Yeah, I mean, unless he earns a very small amount of money, you would think you'd get a notice from the IRS if somebody's reporting your income, right?
And we're talking 20 years.
Yeah.
20 years. So have you been talking to him about this?
Yes, and he actually brought it up.
When? How far into your relationship did he bring it up?
Oh, early in our relationship. I knew this when we were young.
And yet you stayed with him?
I've always paid my taxes, and so I don't worry about it too much, you know, like that was on him.
And you two have been together for 20 years, but you never married, right?
Correct.
And do you have children?
Yes.
Is this a reason, perhaps, why you did not get married?
Finances are probably, I would say, 99% of it.
Yeah. Really? Wow.
I don't want to share my finances with someone whose finances aren't good because I work very hard to keep good financial records and credit scores and what have you.
What was his justification for not filing?
I know that he was never taught about money as a child. Few other members of his family are kind of like that. So I'm trying to help him.
Is it a touchy issue when the two of you talk about it?
Yes.
Yeah, so tax time rolls around and you're kind of going, well, maybe this year you could finally do it, hon? Maybe?
Right. But at this point, he's afraid. I would think if you go in this year and file taxes that something will go off in the system and you will be contacted and, you know.
I think that's a safe bet.
What he needs to do is sit down with a professional because he's going to need to reconstruct those 20 years of tax returns. The unfortunate thing about not filing is that there is no statute of limitations on how far back the IRS can go if you didn't file. So he needs to actually go back, figure out he's had withholding taken out of his checks. That's great, because it probably means he's not in as big of a hole as he might be otherwise.
With the exception of all those penalties and fees that he's going to have to pay.
Yeah,
interest.
Yeah.
Right.
But if your reasoning on why he didn't file is right, the IRS is more sympathetic to somebody who's just kind of a rube than somebody who's trying to cheat.
Absolutely. And I assure you that is the case. The professional you speak of, we just heard of what's called the taxpayer advocacy.
Right.
Service.
Yep.
Taxpayer
advocate.
And we were thinking, would that be better than calling one of these lawyers you see on television?
If your tax problems are affecting your family life, you need to know that you have options. You have rights, and we'll make sure you get them. Call and speak.
Not the way to go, right?
No, definitely not.
That's exactly what I was talking about.
Definitely don't call a lawyer that you see on television. The taxpayer advocate can definitely help you. But what you need to do first is before you contact anybody at the IRS, you need to be talking to a tax professional that will help you walk through it and understand both what your tax could be and what the penalty could be. You need somebody who really knows the rules.
And I'm going to reference here that we actually had a conversation with the tax commissioner a few weeks ago during tax time, Doug Shulman. And he said that the IRS is actually, particularly in these recessionary times, really trying to work with people. You know, he did try to emphasize that it's much better to come in and try to work with the IRS than have them catch you at some point down the line.
Right. One way or the other, you're going to have to do all of this paperwork. You're going to have to figure out how much you owe or don't owe. You need to contact his employer and get those W-2s.
For every every year?
For every single year. It's, you know, when you have a 20-year-old problem, mm-hmm. the solution is not easy.
So, Janine, it sounds like this is going to be a lot of work for you, but is he worth the sacrifice? Is he worth the effort to you?
Yeah.
After 20 years?
Yeah, you're sure you don't want to just dump him
now
quickly?
Well, I'm glad to hear that. That means that he's a good guy.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate all the information. And yeah, I guess it's just time to do a little legwork.
I think it is. And so how about we give you a call around tax time next year and see what y'all came up with?
That would be great.
Okay.
Good luck, Janine.
Thank you very much.
Well, you may not be hiding from the man, but we know you do have money questions, so give us a call. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY, or you can always write us an email. You'll find the Getting Personal link at marketplace.org. Let's go to Concord, North Carolina, and Steve is on the line. Hi, Steve.
Hello, how are you?
Very well, and you?
Pretty good.
So what do you do there in North Carolina?
I drive a truck.
A truck driver. This is, I think this is our second truck driver 2 weeks in a row. So you guys like Marketplace Money, huh?
Yeah, you listen to a lot of radio, huh?
I listen to you guys all the time during, on the road.
All right. So what do you do when you're off the road?
I spend time with my family. It's a big priority for me. That's why I'm trying to get out of the trucking industry. I tried to, I've only been driving for about 8 months. I used to work for GM as a service manager for a couple dealerships for about 30 years, and I had to get out of that because it was going nowhere.
Were you laid off, or did you leave voluntarily?
No, I was laid off.
Yeah.
I went from making about 85 grand a year down to about 25,000.
Ouch.
Wow.
Ouch.
So you decided to go into trucking because that was basically a place where you could get an income.
Well, absolutely. That is an industry that's not going anywhere.
Is it mostly the time away from family that's making it difficult for you?
Absolutely. It's real tough on my 15-year-old.
Yeah.
We're best friends. We spend a lot of time together. And
now, Steve, are there any possibilities with your old profession, not necessarily with GM, but could you be a service manager for Toyota or Honda or Ford?
You know, we're all dime of a dozen now. They can afford to pay you really, really minimum. The pay scales that I was checking with were, you know, say you get $500 a month guarantee and the rest is commission. In the automotive industry, I don't know if I should be saying this, but you almost have to take advantage of people. I was going to use a different word, but
we can fill in the blank.
Yeah. You have to take advantage of people to make the commission. And I got a lot of my clientele through honesty. And there's not a lot of honesty in the dealerships.
Yeah, you're the guy who we all ask around with our friends and everybody we know to try to find a good guy in the mechanic field.
Absolutely. Right.
Well, talk to us a little bit about what the financial situation is now. Do you have any sort of savings, or are you?
No, when I got laid off, I was not able to find a job for a good 6-8 months.
Wow.
And I was unemployment. We drained our savings completely. We just barely made our mortgage payments. Just before that, because I never saw this coming, we had bought a couple motorcycles, dirt bikes for the kids. So we accumulated a couple, two or three more payments.
Well, you know, Kathy, it feels like we are getting more and more of this kind of letter and phone call from listeners where, you know, they've been out of work for a long time, really no prospects, or they've taken a job that really isn't working out. There are a lot of issues going on here with Steve. So can we pick maybe a couple that he could try to work on right away?
I understand how difficult it is because you're talking about being away for a month at a time. But what I would do at this stage is I would get everybody pulling for the team. You say you have a 15-year-old. I'd be talking to my 15-year-old and say, this is a really tough time. I need your help. I want to see if you will get a job after school. And I'm not asking you to pay household expenses, but maybe pay for your own prom. Maybe you need to get rid of those dirt bikes. While these are really difficult things to do and you don't want to accept that life has changed so much, they're also character building.
Steve, what about credit card debt? Is that something that is an issue as well?
We probably have 15,000, 17,000.
Oh, wow. Boy. I know this is not what you want to hear, but I'm thinking you need to get rid of the dirt bikes and use that money to pay off the credit cards.
The bikes are actually almost paid off. They'll be about another year. But because the situation where I don't have a lot of time spending with my family, so when I get home, I think that's a huge piece of glue that is given as something to do when we're together.
Yeah, I mean, I think that really and truly, obviously, you really want these dirt bikes, but you probably want to eat, too.
So I think what Kathy is saying is that, you know, it is all about your choices, and you really need to figure out what are your needs and what are your wants.
Right.
Kathy, is a credit counselor in order at this point?
A credit counselor may be in order. The other thing I just think you really need to think about is your other 8 hours. The time that you're using right now that is not being used in some productive work to generate income. There's a book called Your Other 8 Hours, and it talks about how to use that time to generate additional income. You've got to do something right now to beat down that credit card debt as fast as you can and to get as financially stable as you can on every front. Otherwise, a few months from now, things could be considerably worse, right, Tess?
Yeah. So, Steve, it sounds to me like your first step may be going to a credit counselor. And then I think what Kathy is saying is that even though you're on the road so much and, you know, then you get home and you want to spend that time with your family, right now what your family really needs is money coming in the door.
Right.
And, you know, maybe for that time that you're home and off the road, you need to find some temporary work.
Right.
And your family's going to understand.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of families out there in the same boat.
True.
So it's a little tough love, Steve, from the folks here at Marketplace Money.
Yeah, sorry.
Yeah.
If there was an easy way out, believe me, we would have tried to give it to you, but I don't think there is.
Thanks so much for the call, Steve.
All right. Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye.
All right. And now we go next to Jen, and she is in New Concord, Ohio. Hi, Jen.
Hi.
I hope that your situation is not as dire as Steve's.
It certainly isn't. No.
Yeah. Well, good. So are you employed? Do you have a job?
I retired in 2002 from a full-time job. But
oh, good for you.
I have a part-time job as a director of an Art and Gillingham Learning Center.
Oh.
We have kids starting off in the first grade if they're struggling with reading, and we try to get them up to grade level.
Kathy, I think that's such a perfect example of what we do really call the new retirement, which is, you know, people still want to have involvement in the community. They want to stay active. And what better way than to help tutor kids who are in need?
It's great fun.
Oh, that's wonderful. That sounds like an ideal retirement, really.
So are you on a fixed income?
I guess you'd say yes. We have not tapped into our retirement income. We're 67. We're waiting for 72 and a half.
Well, it sounds to me like you did everything right. Why do you need us?
Well, it's not us. We have two sons. And the one younger son lost his job in New York City and moved home. And he doesn't want to stay around here at this time. So he's going to be moving to Portland, Maine. And he is married. They are going to move to Portland, get an apartment, and then look for jobs. Well, that makes me very nervous.
Yeah.
We would never, even in New Concord, rent to somebody without a job.
So you're wanting to know how to talk some sense into these folks.
Yes. Is there a better way that I could suggest that they approach this?
Have you had to school your son in finances before?
Yes. We have. We paid for his graduate school because we took out a loan against our house. And
wow.
And then when the bottom was falling out, we said, we got to get rid of this loan.
Are they paying you back the amount that you paid it off?
At the moment, no.
Okay. Mm. To me, the thing as a parent that I can do with my kids, because they need to make their own economic decisions, right?
Yeah.
What you can do is you can lead them in the direction of thinking logically about it, but you don't get to make the decision for them.
But when they start involving the parents, that's when I...
If they're asking you for money...
And have they?
They haven't yet. No.
They haven't yet.
I'm trying to get ahead of them because I really don't think in this financial state with the economy, we should be co-signing even for an apartment.
Hmm.
Well, I think you're wise to be thinking through this, and I think you're also wise to get ahead of it in a discussion.
Yeah.
Your son isn't going to be resentful about you saying, I can't afford this, unless it's at the very last minute.
But so, Kathy, what you're saying is you have to make absolutely clear to them that the bank of mom and dad has shut its doors.
Yeah. That there is no bank of mom and dad anymore. Mom and dad are retired, and they need to maintain their assets so they don't become a burden on you, son, someday. So,
right.
So,
right.
Yes.
Yeah, tough conversation, but really necessary at this point.
Absolutely.
Maybe you could just listen to this show together.
That might not be the most diplomatic way to handle it. Thanks so very much.
Thanks for the call.
Thank you.
You can give us a call at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Or email your question. You can do that with the Getting Personal link at marketplace.org. Kathy Kristoff, it's been awfully fun. Thanks so much for coming in.
Well, thank you. It's always a blast, even though we have to listen to pretty difficult stories.
Yeah, right? Yeah, but hopefully it helps.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Let's hope that it works out for Steve in particular. Well, actually, everybody had challenging issues this
challenging
time.
But we didn't stump you.
No.
We never do.
No.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And remember to check with your own financial expert before you make any big money decisions. Money back on a purchase? Why, yes, please. But rebates aren't always what they seem.
It's easy to understand why manufacturers love them. They move merchandise and help promote new products. But there's so much of the time that they don't have to pay out.
Time to regulate the rebate? That's coming up later in the show. Looks like we're officially in a stock market correction. Stocks dropped again this week. The Dow is now off some 10% from its recent highs. Many fingers are pointing to Greece and the European Union's fragmented efforts to contain a debt crisis there. How and why is all this affecting your wallet? Well, we'll get to that in a moment. But first, a story from the streets of Athens about how government austerity measures are affecting their wallets. Joanna Kakissis reports.
It's 2 o'clock in the morning in a small, smoky club in central Athens. The opening act, a young man in acid-wash jeans and a Run DMC shirt, is trying to coax a few tired couples to dance to his songs of love and pain and bad, bad luck. It's not working. This club, a place where Greeks used to dance on the tables, is mostly empty. And backstage, the star act, Yorgos Marinis, is talking about the economy.
I think about it all the time, though I have to crack jokes just to break the stress sometimes. I just have to believe the cuts the government is making are going to make this country better, at least for my kids.
Marinis has a 21-year-old son and an 18-year-old daughter to support, and little cash to spare. He refuses to run up huge credit bills. He makes less money now than when he was performing in the 1990s. And the future also looks bleak. He's expecting a big wage cut soon, and he won't have much of a pension when he retires in 10 years. When I ask him how this all makes him feel, he pulls out a photo of Stelios Kazantzidis, a famous Greek singer who spoke to the poor. See this man's face, he says. Do you see the pain? Greece has always been full of so many metaphorical riches, he says, except money. But metaphorical riches are not cutting it for many Greek families nowadays. They're strapped, they know their country is inefficient and corrupt and has to change. But most economists here say that will mean at least 5 years of a prolonged recession. And for Greeks who make on average only $17,000 a year, the cuts will cause real pain, says Jens Bastian, a German economist who has lived here for 13 years.
That is going to be enormously difficult in terms of adjustment, in terms of making ends meet. How will you pay your mortgage? How will you finance the school fees? Where can you start making cuts? And here I'm starting to observe already, private consumption is going down.
Natasa Piropoulou and her two young daughters are at home in Athens. She's a microbiologist assistant. Her husband, Kostas Skoufos, is a driver for a local municipality. By Greek standards, the family is actually well off, bringing in something like $2,500 a month. They've mostly paid off their nice suburban apartment with its little fireplace, where on cold spring days, the girls roast chestnuts. But Natasa's bonuses got cut in March. Kostas' salary got cut a few weeks ago. These days, they seldom eat out and rarely go clothes shopping. Kostas says there's no relief in sight. He expects the government will soon have to impose even tougher austerity measures.
I don't think what the government's done is really enough, as much as it hurts. I just wonder, by taking money out of pockets, how is that supposed to promote development? We need to start producing something to be an efficient country. Every Greek wants that, but we just don't trust the government anymore. All these years, all I've heard is slogans and lies. That's why everyone I know is so pessimistic right now.
His wife Natasa wishes Greece hadn't joined the euro. Everything was less expensive when Greece used its own currency, the drachma, she says.
If our politicians had been decent and organized, I think we could have made it with our little drachma. Maybe it would never have been as big as the euro, but we would have pride and be independent and be just fine. But politicians never do anything but let us down.
Economist Jens Bastian agrees. He says this sense of disappointment has even reached his 13-year-old daughter.
She comes home from time to time from school now and asks, why did we get into this crisis? Why are we being criticized?
Back at the nightclub, Yorgos Marinis is in his tiny dressing room. Two big photographs of his children are taped to his mirror. He's practicing Thalasses, a popular song about uncertain times.
Thalasses, thalasses ta problemata mas lyonun thalasses.
Oh, the seas of worry that dissolve me, he sings. The dirty deeds of the world, the bitterness. Oh, seas how we judge, we are left alone with our dreams unfulfilled. In the last few months, he says, he sings that song practically every night. It's by far the most popular request. In Athens, I'm Joanna Kakissis for Marketplace Money.
So one way or another, Greece is going to have to pay down its debt and Greek families will take the hit. But what about American families? Stock market investors are certainly paying close attention to every word out of the European Union about rescue packages and the like. But what could troubles in Greece really mean for us? For some answers, we turn to Jacob Kierkegaard of the Peterson Institute for International Economics. Welcome.
My pleasure.
I'm going to start with the very basic of basics and ask you to explain for us why what is happening in Greece has anything to do with us.
Well, first and foremost, what is happening in Greece has been sort of a canary in the coal mine. It basically points to a freeze in the credit markets, similar to what we saw after the collapse of Lehman Brothers. And if that had happened, that could have had very, very dramatic implications for the United States economy more broadly, and most certainly for the U.S. financial system.
Let's try to draw the line from that to a blue-collar worker here in the U.S. Why is there a trickle-down effect?
There's going to have a net negative impact on the job-generating capacity of the U.S. economy. When the European economy goes into a tailspin, the ability for U.S. manufacturers to sell their goods in Europe declines. That's the first order. There's another equally important effect. We've seen a very dramatic decline in the exchange rate of the euro vis-a-vis the dollar.
Mm-hmm.
And that has meant that when European and American manufacturers compete for export orders, European competitors now have a significant pricing advantage because of the decline in the exchange rate.
Now, it also seems that the panic in Europe is affecting stock market recovery. Is it the case that if things continue to go badly over there, that it's going to affect stock markets here and worldwide?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I mean, that's the kind of message that we're now seeing in the stock markets, basically thinking, well, if Europe, a large part of the global economy, is going to underperform, that's not going to be good for the overall global recovery.
You mentioned the fact that the euro has dropped against the dollar recently, and you know there are negative effects of that worldwide. And yet, if you are a potential tourist in Europe, I suppose this would be the time to go.
Well, I mean, most certainly. I mean, you know, the Icelandic volcanoes permitting,
right.
going to Europe during this summer is going to be anywhere between 20 to 25% cheaper than it was last year. The exchange rate, which used to be easily 150 mm-hmm. to the euro, might now decline to as much as 110. That's a lot of money if you want to go to restaurants and spend money in Europe.
Well, let me ask you this then. Even around our office here at Marketplace, there have been questions about, boy, should I go out and buy euros right now? Is now the time to buy the euro if you're planning perhaps to travel, or should you wait a few months and wait for it to go down even further?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, if you're planning to travel to Europe during the rest of 2010, I would certainly not want to buy my euros now, because my prediction, to the extent that anybody is willing to predict,
right.
predict a foreign exchange rate, but I'm going to stick my neck out and say I would certainly wait as long as I could to do that, because my distinct feeling is that the euro has got some way to go down still.
All right. Well, thanks for checking in on your crystal ball for us. Jacob Kierkegaard is a research fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. Thanks so much.
My pleasure.
And just in case there's one nagging question in your minds about our interview, I wondered too. I mean, how many Kierkegaards could there be, right? So before we started chatting about the euro, I asked, is he related?
In theory, yes.
Really?
I'm originally Danish, and nobody can say that they're related to Kierkegaard because he didn't have any children.
Ah.
But one of his paternal uncles was my many times great-grandfather. So that is the connection.
So are you a philosophical, political mind then?
Well, I mean, you know, actually sort of existentialism has come in handy a little bit in the last couple of years.
So about that Greek vacation you've been putting off for years, we just heard from Mr. Kierkegaard that it might be a good time to make that happen. But just because you'd get way more bang for your buck doesn't mean you can throw caution to the wind. For some more advice on how to use the euro's devaluation to your advantage, we turn to David Lytle of Fromers.com, and he offered us some tips on how to make the most out of an opportune moment.
Something we always recommend to our readers is that they invest in trip insurance. You can go to insuremytrip.com, which will allow you to compare the cost of policies against all the travel insurance providers. So you can find something that's within your price range, but it's going to be between 3% to 8% of your total cost of travel.
I've always heard that that's a waste of money.
I don't think that it is. You know, you may not necessarily want to get trip insurance if you're flying from where I live in San Francisco, say to Indianapolis for, you know, a $250 ticket.
Yeah.
But if your trip is involving hotels, some train tickets, a plane ticket, and, you know, your cost is going to be up there like $5,000, this is going to average you maybe about $300 additional. You look at it actually as insurance. If a volcano explodes and suddenly you can't fly, you have a reason to cancel your trip and get your money back, minus the $300.
Right, right. And I guess the caution here is that if you are planning travel based on the currency of your destination, aren't you basically speculating in currency?
There's something that we publish once a month called our Global Price Index, and we look at 10 to 12 destinations around the world and compare it against the dollar, which is our primary audience for our readership online, mm-hmm. just to let them sort of see where is the dollar doing stronger against others. And people do base their decision upon where they're going to get more buying power. There's always the chance that an economy is totally going to go bust. I don't know if anybody is going to be able to predict that absolutely. There were rumors for a long time that Greece was in trouble.
Right.
You know, Portugal looks like it might be the next country to have to be bailed out by the EU. And Portugal and Greece are actually looking like good destinations to plan vacations if you want to get more buying power for your dollar.
Well, I was just going to ask you that. Is there a place that you would suggest going right now? I mean, I don't know. I've seen a lot of buildings set on fire in Greece. Would I want to go there?
You know, I think Americans are high-risk aversion travelers. You know, something that is happening in a very particular location in Athens is not happening across all the islands of Greece.
Oh, yes. Santorini is still beautiful, I would assume.
Exactly. Rhodes is still beautiful. And unfortunately, what they're starting to see in the double digits, cancellations for hotels. So now they're starting to reduce their prices, trying to get travelers to come to them.
We've been talking about what the euro's decline means for Americans traveling abroad, but I wonder about the reverse. Does this mean also, I would assume, that Europeans perhaps won't be flocking to, say, New York City in the numbers that they have been?
Yeah, I think we're definitely going to see an inverse of, you know, what I've been seeing here where I live, again, in San Francisco. You know, just in the past 2 years, as our economy went bust, I saw a great increase in the number of European travelers, and I might say very happy European travelers, who are walking through the Union Square area where we have a lot of our high-end shopping with armloads of bags,
right,
just, you know, buying up luxury goods because their currency was going so much farther. Now, I think we might see a slight inverse. If we can get Americans over to Europe, you're going to start seeing some Americans who have managed their money well and have some to spend, maybe buying some jewelry, maybe buying some, you know, nicer pieces that they can bring back as souvenirs.
Any plans on your part to head abroad across the pond?
Past couple of weeks, I've been looking at a trip with my partner to go to Greece in the fall.
Really?
And maybe tack on Egypt to that, yeah. Two areas that I have always wanted to go to that I just haven't been able to fit into my life yet. You know, there's always someplace else to go.
Well, be sure to send us the photos when you're there.
Oh, absolutely. I'll post them on Fromers.com so you can see them there.
David Lytle is editorial director at Fromers.com. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Who doesn't love a rebate, right? I mean, you pay for something, and then you send away some paperwork, and you get money back. It's a win-win, too, because retailers love them. The lower the price on a stereo or blender, the more likely you are to buy it. But there's a catch.
40% of all mail-in rebates go uncollected.
Todd Marks is a senior editor at Consumer Reports, and you heard him right. 40% of us never bother sending in the paperwork. Or we mess up the forms, or we miss the deadline to apply. Bad for us, but
it's easy to understand why manufacturers love them. They move merchandise and help promote new products. But there's so much of the time that they don't have to pay out. You often have to jump through hoops to collect on these rebates. The higher the dollar value of the rebate, the more hoops you have to jump through.
So lawmakers in New Jersey are looking to turn the tables on stores like Best Buy and Target. They've introduced a bill that would force sellers to apply for the rebate themselves if they want to advertise after rebate prices to their shoppers. So you'd get the rebate instantly instead of waiting weeks or even months to collect it. See how they like filling out 23 pages to get 10 bucks back on a microwave. Again, Consumer Reports, Todd Marks.
It's like spinning around the whole equation. It's putting the onus on the retailer to collect from the manufacturer rather than the consumer having to go through all these hoops. Isn't that great?
Score one for the little guy, right?
Chances are they'll come up with another gimmick. It's to some extent, I guess it's sort of like terrorism, where you have to stay one step ahead of the bad guys.
Small victory, I guess. And that's Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, moving to suburbia was supposed to save families money, but now it's the commute that's killing them.
You could see approximately $1,400 a month for transportation in that area.
And we'll take a walk through the debates on Capitol Hill about financial reform. Marketplace Money is produced by Deborah Clark with Stephen Hoffman and Jolie Myers. Our technical director is Josh Rogerson. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. And special thanks this week to senior editor Patty Hirsch. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again. Marketplace Money is supported by Putnam Investments, offering strategies for investors seeking both returns and lower volatility. On the web at putnam.com/absolute return.
American Public Media.